Welcome back. You met Arkady Plotnitsky a few minutes ago. Here he is again.
Thank you for this wonderful introduction and the it's a very generous introduction. I'm not going to issue any apologies as usual, but I just issue a few warning signs. It's going to be an extremely pedestrian, boring talk. I understand that you're all tired at this point, and for the physicist, I will have to say that I will only have to say trivial things with the hope that I will be able to say trivial things about non-trivial things. And for the humanist, I think that you will see that I will maybe somewhat at odds concerning the perception or reception of the play like Copenhagen, about which I'm going to talk a little bit, because I changed slightly my presentation for any number of reasons. The title of my presentation as presented in the program, apart through the whatever glitches in the communications being ungrammatical, is slightly dead, right? That is to say, a new title is Staging and Representation in Classical Physics, Quantum Theory, and Drama. So I'll have 10 minutes to talk about classical physics, 10 minutes to talk about quantum theory, and 10 minutes about postmodern drama. It's plenty of time. So I would like to begin with the preliminary Kantian definition of representation in the sense of German word Darstellung, putting forward in representation. The word is also used in German for the stage representation, which from Kant, or indeed Plato and Aristotle, the Greek would be my missus, on link the question of representation and hence philosophy and implicitly science, at least classical physics, from Aristotle on to stage representation or theater. Now, here's the definition which follows Professor Porter's definition of narrative. A representation is something standing for something else, or more accurately, something giving standing for something that may or may not be given. This view accordingly assumes, or this definition in the first place, that there is that something else for which the first something could stand or which it can represent. Thus, one assumes that this second something, although possibly unknowable in practice or even in principle, can still be conceived, at least in principle, in specific conceptual form, say by analogy with already available phenomena or conceptions. The latter view, in particular, define Kantian things in themselves, something that is, Kant says, not knowable but thinkable, at least in the sense of denken, thinking in German, if not Darstellen. I shall call this type of epistemology classical as an important nuance, right? This classical epistemology implies that the thing could not be knowable, but you can still think about it in one way or another. For example, in quantum physics, especially at earlier stages of quantum physics, one could think of the behavior of quantum objects, such as electrons or photons, on the model of the objects and motions of classical physics, such as planets moving around the sun. This is indeed how one thought about electrons moving around nuclei and atoms in the early stages of quantum theory. Such models are idealizations, abstracted from actual natural objects and processes in part in order to make these models mathematical and to make physics itself, in Galileo's terms, a mathematical science of nature. These idealizations are accordingly representational in the present view, if not actually, but only approximately representing nature itself. Eventually, this classical or representational view of quantum object was replaced by what I call the non-classical representation in Heisenberg and Bohr's sense, or as the case may be, unrepresentability and even inconceivability, unthinkability of such object. In this view, such behavior cannot be represented or possibly even conceived of, even though it has observable effects, such as spectra constituting the data of atomic theory. I shall accordingly call this type of epistemology non-classical. That is to say, this is a crucial point, right, in which we deal with the effect of something upon the world of which we can conceive of thing, the things of which we cannot even conceive, possibly. Just to anticipate what I'm going to say, from that viewpoint, there is neither waves nor particles in quantum theory. Both are convenient fiction used for the economy of discourse. It's common, of course, that waves have no physical meaning in quantum theory, but neither do particles, according to this view. Let me just also anticipate very briefly and to say, for the sake of time, I'm going to speak only about one particular representation which I associate with Bohr, or with certain interpretation of Bohr's interpretation, because at this point, as my friend David Merman says, there are as many interpretations of quantum mechanics of the word God in Talmud, and I should add that some of these interpretations are one and the same, right? The earlier view of atomic constitution just described, of planetary model, immediately led to difficulties. These difficulties compelled Bohr to break with certain key principles of classical physics already in his 1913 theory of the hydrogen atom, and by so doing to anticipate certain features of non-classical theory. The persistent failure to adjust this, as it was called in terms of physics rather than epistemology, semi-classical approach to account for the data in question, eventually led to quantum mechanics and then to the kind of non-classical epistemology developed by Bohr, which I'm talking about. In physics, the term classical is usually juxtaposed to quantum or relativistic physics, although the term non-classical is sometimes used, including by Bohr, in reference to quantum mechanics to distinguish it from classical physics. Quantum physics, however, might also be, and here will be, as I said, interpreted as epistemologically non-classical theory. By contrast, as I indicated above, classical physics, such as Newtonian mechanics, may be and usually is seen as representational in the present definition, insofar as the object and motion considered are only idealizations suitably mathematized of actual physical bodies and their motions rather than these bodies themselves. By the same token, it is also essentially constitutively narrative or narrativized science, insofar as a classical physical description of motion is essentially a story, a sequence of events. Of course, I understand that some definitions of a narrative implies they have a human or other comparable agent. But what I'm saying that some narrative structures which are used in narratives could be used in classical physics. We recall that at the outset and ushering in existence modern physics, setting in motion, if you like, the ship of modern physics, Galileo tells the story of loading a ship with all manner of living creatures, in turn perhaps alluding to the story of Noah's Ark. He then invites his readers to enact the experiment, at least as a thought experiment, and to contemplate the fact that we would not observe any difference between the ship or it follows the world around us, standing still or uniformly moving. In this case, the narrative is science. What I'm saying that this narrative is constitutive. It's not used to describe science. It is used to start science, rather than merely serving to illustrate key scientific concepts. And so far, this particular aspect of modern physics, and indeed the very idea of motion, which grounds all physics, may not be conveyed without a narrative. Something moves is a narrative. Every time something begins to move, a narrative begins. And conversely, every time there is a narrative, something begins to move, or at least stands still, which still requires the idea of motion, as Vladimir Prop taught us long ago. In this sense, Aristotle's essential structural link of narrative, plot, Greek word of course, mythos, and stage representation in poetics, apart from its significance in its own terms, bears equally essentially, and for Aristotle clearly deliberately, on our conceptions of physics, beginning with Aristotle's own physics. To be sure, an equally essential role of chance and physics in poetics. It's probable that improbable events happen, Aristotle famously says in Poetics, complicates the matter, but does not take it into a non-classical field, since a certain underlying, albeit unknown, narrative plot appears to be presupposed. Self-evidently, our conception of history is equally at stake here as well. Aristotle does not seem to leave anything untouched, with equally self-evidently crucial implications for how we tell the story of science itself, quantum theory, for example. That is the difference of this paper from Aristotle, that everything interesting will be left outside my presentation. There's no time. And I think history would require another 5 minutes, but I don't have to address that crucial question here. At this point, I'm going to change the register of my presentation, which I have to relearn in addressing a scientific audience, and I speak to scientists relatively regularly, that I switch from reading a paper, but I wanted to demonstrate to my literary colleague that I'm capable of writing a paper. But what I'm going to now to argue now, that neither a narrative nor concomitantly representational, a plot-like causal staging of event is not only not possible, this again could be true classically, but is not presupposable at the level of quantum objects, the monstrous word presupposable, it's terrible, but at the level of quantum object or even at the level of measuring instrument where we only have certain effect without causal connections between them. In other words, let me just explain to you quantum mechanics. Not quantum mechanics, or rather quantum phenomena, right? It could be explained with the help of the so-called double slit experiment, which was already invoked here on any number of occasions. Of course, all of you know that quantum theory, quantum mechanics of 1925 was, of course, developed as a theory of electrons moving in the atom. I'll come to that in a second. But for all intents and purposes, things are contained in this archetypal paradigmatic experiment of quantum physics, which consists in the following arrangement. You have the slits. I inserted this single slit in between. You can ignore it. It's not really that important, but it sometimes used in Bohr's diagrams on this paper. This diagram is taken from a discussion of Bohr. So you have this arrangement here at which there is a source. There is the diagram with two slits, and there is a screen with an emulsion on which I'm tempted to say particle leaves a trace, but I don't want to say that. I say in which we see a certain picture. If we switch the light, right, at a certain periods of time, right, we will see a certain picture. Now, this picture will be different depending on the fact whether we install another device here, which clicks sometimes. Well, it's difficult, but let me assume that we have particles, right? Let me assume that we talk about the emission of particles, right? If there is no devices, right? If I shoot a particle every second, every year, every whatever within physical, you will see that there will be the emergence of a certain pattern, which looks like a wave pattern. But what is important for me at the moment, that it's only a wave-like pattern, because you see these are all dots. I have the picture how it actually looks on the photograph. You need like at least over 100,000 occurrences to get this pattern to begin to emerge, because if you just shoot one by one, you don't see anything, you know, in that way, right? Now, here's the miracle and mystery of quantum mechanics, which, as I said, has no mysticism, that if you put the counter, and which will allow you automatically to know through which slit the object would pass, then the interference pattern will inevitably disappear. That is to say, you don't even have to do these clicks. In principle, setting this up will make this inevitable. The essence of quantum mechanical phenomenon consists in that peculiar behavior that you have two types of traces on the photographic emulsion depending upon how you arrange your measuring instrument. Don't have time to talk about that, but I can tell you right now, just take my word for it, that this statement is exactly equivalent to Heisenberg's uncertainty relations. It is the same thing, the Heisenberg uncertainty relations, right? And that fact that installing another device which allows us to know through which slit the particle passes is equivalent to the uncertainty relation, leads to disappearance of the interference pattern. I do disagree with one of the speakers before who said that the interference pattern introduces a certain degree of chaos. It's not true. It's au contraire. The interference Fratton introduces a certain order of classical physics, additional correlations. It tells you that both slits are open, the behavior is not exactly random, not as random as it would be in classical physics. It is ordered. Quantum mechanics, in a certain sense, has more order than classical physics, in spite of the uncertainty. Uncertainty relations, sometimes also known as an indeterminacy, and the best terms would not be used is unknowability relations, right? Relate to this situation. It is also true, in addition to that, that this fact, right, this fact, makes quantum mechanics irreducibly statistical theory. That means the following, that the outcome of single events are not subject to the law. There is no physical law except the law of probability, a throw of dice, which allows you to predict the outcome of a single event. So it means that this pattern only emerges in the result of the collective behavior. All right, now, there is, just to give a little relaxation of tension, this, of course, is paradoxical, right? There is no question that that picture is paradoxical or peculiar. In a certain sense, it would appear that somehow particles know whether the counters are installed or not. I mean, sometimes when I teach these things to undergraduates who are literature major, I want to say the paradox disappears and I give a caricature version of Bohm's theory of quantum mechanics. I think the paradox disappears under these conditions. If electrons can communicate instantly and travel can communicate faster than the speed of light, then there is no paradox. Because then the electron passed by, and one electron says, guys, the counter is not there. Let's arrange ourselves in a pattern. Oh, no, they installed the counter itself. Forget about it. Just let's behave randomly, right? So if you have this element, right, this paradox in Bohm's theory indeed disappears if you have instantaneous connections between the elements. Now, of
course. That's not true. That's not why.
Okay. The fact that you study with Bohm doesn't guarantee that this is true. Can I finish the talk? It's all right. Okay, it's okay. I said it's a caricature of Bohm's theory. I said it's a caricature.
You don't need that at all.
I don't. I don't need it. Okay. All right. Now, Niels Bohr. It's a different way out of this paradox, right? His way of resolving paradoxes as follows. The behavior of quantum objects, right, which is unexplainable by these terms, cannot be explained, right? Quantum mechanics, which incidentally makes exact quantitative predictions of these patterns. It doesn't mean that it simply predicts the pattern, which would not be interesting, for that you don't need quantum mechanics, that you can observe. But quantum mechanics will predict exact distribution of these patterns, depending where the slits are, what the distances are, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the quantum mechanics as a physical theory makes quantitative predictions concerning the distribution of these dots, because the previous experiment was entirely qualitative, right? Quantum mechanics enables you to make exact quantitative predictions, right? According to Bohr's view, this limit, beyond which you cannot penetrate into the knowledge of quantum object, is strictly quantitatively established by Planck constant, right, and uncertainty relations. That is to say that beyond that level, I don't have it right here, but I know it by heart, right? He said, we have to understand the argument which Einstein rejects outright, that in quantum theory, we're not dealing with arbitrary enunciation of the analysis beyond certain limits, but with the recognition that such an analysis is in principle excluded. That is, they have to understand that beyond certain limits, this analysis will be excluded altogether, according to this view, right? That will enact a resolution of quantum mechanical paradox. He leads Bohr to his concept of phenomena as an individual phenomenon in quantum mechanics. That phenomena is quantum event. In this scheme is occurrence of a dot. Okay, now, unlike the phenomena in the sense of Husserl or even Kant's phenomenology, in which a dot is a dot is a dot is a dot, in Bohr's theory, a dot is not a dot, is not a dot, is not a dot, because it depends on the arrangement. If the both slits are open and there is no counter, the dot is considered as one type of phenomena. If there are counters, it's considered the other type of phenomena, even though in each individual case, it's just still a dot. And indeed, for individual case, it wouldn't matter. This argument only works collectively because the individual events are not predictable. One of the great mysteries of quantum theory is indeed this: how the absolutely random individual events manage to combine in ordered multiplicity of events. That's one of the profound mysteries of quantum mechanics. The wave function of Schrödinger's wave functions, and that's the significance or interpretation of quantum waves, although it involves many further complexities, involves the distribution of probabilities of occurrence of individual event. The wave function gives you that statistical pattern. If you write the Schrödinger equation, it will give you this pattern once you put in all the data, where the slits are, where you start, what the distances are, etc. But it will not give you a prediction of an individual event. It will be 50-50, roughly speaking. Depends on the quantum mechanics makes some exact predictions, but won't have time to talk about that. Now, I just want to stress the following point, right? That according to this view, this limit of quantum theory, beyond which any analysis of what is going in is a principle excluded, is absolute, right? It's not that you can push it, etc. So that is ends my presentation of quantum mechanics, and it ends my unpresentation of Bohm's theory, and I accept the objection because it was not fair. But it's nice. It's a nice rhetorical device. Anyway, in any event, let me say this. That paradox will be resolved under the conditions that electron communicates instantaneously, have consciousness, but there is no need to associate it with David Bohm's theory. Okay. Let me get out of the way. Okay. All right. Now, it's clear, of course, that this view, right, has profound implications for the representations of the event and using quantum theory as a metaphor, concept, etc., in a dramatic representation. Now, it is true, of course, that in any local case, let's consider Copenhagen, right, the event we didn't know what happened, right? You could use this idea that certain other things happened, but we cannot possibly know how things happened, what led. This is a mystery which cannot be known. Now, there is, however, a profound difference at the same time. Insofar as we deal with human narratives, we can push this limit almost infinitely far. We can continue to construct the story. It could happen this way, or it could happen that way. Maybe it happened that way, maybe it happened the other way. But in quantum physics, it's only possible up to a certain limit. Beyond that limit, you cannot conceive of the processes. I mean, that's what this means non-classical. In a certain sense, the difficulty of representing the idea of chance. Wittgenstein once says, we cannot think of non-causal processes. It's just beyond the capacities of our thinking. Is that you can continue along Kant's idea of things in themselves. You don't know what happened between Heisenberg and Bohr in that famous meeting, right? Or infamous meeting. But you can think about that. In fact, Kant says, I can think anything I want. In so far, he says, I do not contradict myself, but it's a fact, even that is not a requirement. But in quantum mechanics, in order to get the numbers right, and without getting the numbers right, there's no physics, right? You cannot think in the way you want according to that interpretation, right? I'm not concerned with the debate at the moment. I'm telling you that there is this type of interpretation, which implies this type of epistemology, which consistent, complete, and in addition to that, local. That is to say, for those who know, it means that quantum mechanics is a local theory, which is not in conflict with special relativity theory, as Bohm's theory is a string claim, even though there are versions of Bohm's theory in which this conflict is not manifest, but it will be there according to the mathematics of the theory. Okay, now, from that point of view, of course, you can see that the analogies and the usages of scientific and metaphors of representation in quantum mechanics, right, have limited value. The circulation of all this idea, paradoxical, uncertain, unknown, is extremely unrigorous. And Bohr's interpretation is designed to avoid the paradoxes at all costs. That is to say, this interpretation contains no paradox. There are no paradoxical properties of quantum objects. There is no volition attributed to nature. There is only a combination of certain individual phenomena which could combine into complex collective phenomena differently under different experimental circumstances. The cost you pay, you don't know how it's possible. Of course, Einstein didn't like it, because for him it was not physics. Okay, and quantum mechanics, in a certain sense, is not quite physics. It's a form of information processing, right? That is to say, certain quantum information theory takes advantage of that. However, I want to say that for Bohr, of course, that was not quite the case. For him, it was a different type of physics. It's not that quantum mechanics is not concerned, is only interested in communicating information. But it can't know what is going on at the level of quantum objects. Not only cannot know, you cannot conceive. From that point of view, ideas such as motion, particle, waves do not apply. In fact, just to give you the illustration by way of a picture, ignore some mathematics of it, it looks something like this. There's a slit, there's something like passing through it, something like a black hole, forgive me using that metaphor. It hits the screen, and there you see the dot. But if you put this dot under the microscope, you will see enormously complex structure, which is in effect initiated by that collision. We presume, we apply all these ideas of collision, etc., because it's the only way to communicate some of these things. But that is the picture. See, this is the, if something hits, something passes through, and all these dark areas are the areas beyond which we cannot really, any analysis beyond this area would be in principle excluded, according to Bohr. Now, on these grounds, right, the success of Copenhagen as a relation to quantum theory is, of course, mixed, right? Because it's clear that the representation of quantum theory in Copenhagen in the use of the metaphor of quantum theory is in deep conflict with Bohr's view of quantum theory, right? If this interpretation is correct. In particular, I'll read you one passage, which was sort of performed here earlier. But Heisenberg then says about Cramer's, which incidentally tells you here the law, ambition is part of it, right? I was terrified of him when I first started in the Institute. I had this discussion, by the way, with Bohr's son about these things in the room where Heisenberg used to live. There's some uncertainty about that because the partitions were changed, right? I was terrified of all of them. All the boys wonder you have the hero. They would be all so brilliant and accomplished. By Cramer's was the heir apparent. All the rest of us, Cramer's incidentally missed on discovering non-commutativity of quantum mechanics. Of us had to work in general study hall. Cramer's had the private office next to yours, was eventually occupied by Heisenberg. Like the electron in the inmost orbit around the nucleus. And he didn't think much of my physics. He insisted you could explain everything about the atom by classical mechanics. And there's a lot of conversation. And Bohr says, with other electrons, all his students and collaborators, at the outer orbits around all over Europe. There's no way that Bohr would have said anything like that in 1941. Because one of the tasks of Heisenberg theory, as he says in a letter to Pauli, who was hesitant about it, he says, my goal was to vanquish, to destroy the idea of orbit, to destroy it, to eliminate it absolutely from quantum theory, right? It's one of the major achievements of quantum theory, and Heisenberg in particular, was the abolition or even partially classical pictures, which would be the idea of orbit. Because in Bohr's view, there were certain orbits which were stable, and there were so-called quantum jumps, which move you to another stable orbit without knowing how that happens. That was the conflict. But with Heisenberg, that didn't work for a variety of reasons. After Heisenberg's theory, the new quantum mechanics abolishes any possible representation. Right? So therefore, the point which I want to make about modern drama and postmodern drama is the limited nature of this analogy as a result of that, right? And unlike many of this audience, I'm really not that fond of Copenhagen as a play. I mean, it's a great literary, high-level literary entertainment. I watched it 5 times, and in fact, you could see in London during the first or second performance, there were a lot of physicists in the audience. You would know that, because many of them was older generation, and whenever something right would be said about quantum mechanics, you would say, yes, 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 yes. And when something would be wrong, say, no. You could see it was performed. I just performed. It was a performance in the total darkness of the theater, right? I'm not humongously fond of this play because I really don't think that in matter of is the structure of this representation, etc., it moves us anywhere beyond what we already know from quantum mechanics. If I want to look for the analogons in contemporary literature of this or more complex ideas, I entirely agree with Sean Carroll's point that the power of using these metaphors is because they tell us something. And you know, this picture, or even this picture, was really absolutely unimaginable. And in its specificity, it was an entirely new concept. There is nothing like that found anywhere in the history of philosophy. You could have found, including in Kant, some anticipations of what is possible and not possible to know. So I think from that point of view, I would look for some more avant-garde works which present some of these ideas indirectly, like in some of the works of Thomas Pynchon. Or, if you like, go a little bit better, would be the dramatists as Heinrich von Kleist, whose work is similar and close to quantum mechanics, not because he knew much physics, but because he read Kant very carefully and drew kind of implications from reading Kant on the basis of his observation of life around him, which were, to my mind, much closer to that. While Copenhagen is, for obvious reasons, right, because the human nature is not quantum mechanics, is a decaffeinated quantum theory. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Arkady. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
It's break time.